Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Shook, An Earthquake, A Legendary Mountain Guide, and Everest's Deadliest Day by Jennifer Hull. Narrated by Adam Werner. Benedicto. May your trails be crooked, winding, lonesome, dangerous, leading to the most amazing view. May your mountains rise into and above the clouds. May your rivers flow without end, meandering through pastoral valleys tinkling with bells, past temples and castles and poets, towers into a dark primeval forest, where tigers belch and monkeys howl, through miasmal and mysterious swamps, and down into a desert of red rock, blue mesas, domes and pinnacles and grottos of endless stone, and down again into a deep, vast, ancient, unknown chasm, where bars of sunlight blaze on profiled cliffs, where deer walk across the white sand beaches, where storms come and go as lightning clangs upon the high crags, where something strange and more beautiful and more full of wonder than your deepest dreams waits for you beyond that next turning of the canyon walls. Edward Abbey. Cast of Characters. Guides. Dave Hahn. The lead guide of the expedition. His childhood was fractured by loss, and he struggled to find his way in life, until he began guiding others in the mountains. He eventually summited Everest 15 times. Chiring Dorji Sherpa. A professional mountain guide born in the Khumbu and Sherpa Sirdar of the expedition, he was forced to abandon his childhood aspirations of becoming a doctor or software engineer when his older brother was killed in an avalanche. Jeffrey James Justman, J.J. A burly mountain guide with a fondness for motorcycling and the Argentinian tango, he called upon his 18 years of experience on the world's highest mountains as the assistant guide of the expedition. Base Camp Manager Mark Tucker. Having summited Everest as a member of the 1990 Peace Climb, he served as the base camp manager of the expedition and was at Everest Base Camp when disaster struck. Clients: Hans Hilscher, the kind and affable CEO of a German technology company, longed to climb each of the 7 summits. Erin Machinchik, an elite rock climber from the Midwest, she contended with the physiological challenges of stage 3 polycystic kidney disease during the high-altitude trek to Everest Base Camp. Robbie Massey. The strong and fit 31-year-old Minnetonka, Minnesota native had trained at the YMCA and saved up for 5 years to bankroll his trip to the highest mountain in the world. Himanshu Parwani, HP. Born in India, the 46-year-old CEO from Dallas, Texas, viewed the Everest expedition as an opportunity to pursue his boyhood dream while raising money for cancer research. Bonnie Rogers, an acupuncturist and experienced trekker from the Washington, D.C. area, Bonnie reluctantly accepted her husband Peter's desire to climb Everest and later decided to join him for the trek to Everest Base Camp. Peter Rogers. Having already summited Aconcagua, Denali, Elbrus, and Vinson, he celebrated his 62nd birthday on the first night of the Everest expedition. Larry Seaton. The 64-year-old founder of a construction firm in Napa Valley, California, had previously scaled the highest peaks of 5 continents, but was stymied by illness and injury during the Everest expedition. Hao Wu. After his 2014 Everest attempt was thwarted when an avalanche in the icefall brought the season to an aborted end, the tenacious venture capitalist was attempting to summit Everest, the final peak in his quest for the 7 summits, for the 2nd time in 2 consecutive years. Everest Figures. Miss Elizabeth Hawley. An American journalist who moved to Kathmandu in 1960 and never left. She chronicled Everest expeditions for over 50 years, conducting dogged and exacting interviews with elite mountaineers and compiling her records in the authoritative Himalayan database. Lama Geshe, the beloved and revered Tibetan Buddhist Lama, blessed trekkers and climbers en route to Chomolungma. Billy Beerling, a journalist and mountaineer from the Bavarian Alps. She worked as an assistant to Elizabeth Hawley at the Himalayan Database. 1. Camp 1, Everest. More than 25 million years ago, India, once a separate island on a quickly sliding piece of the Earth's crust, crashed into Asia. The two land masses are still colliding, pushed together at a speed of 1.5 to 2 inches a year. The forces have pushed up the highest mountains in the world, in the Himalayas. New York Times, April 4th, 2019. In the vast bowl of the Valley of Silence, four canary-yellow tents sat in a row, perched on a narrow fin of glacier, like birds on a wire. Dave Hahn, the lead guide of the 2015 RMI Everest Expedition, and his assistant guide, J.J. Justman, were in the second tent. Beside them, clients Robbie Massey and Peter Rogers shared the first tent. On their other side, Sherpa Sirdar Chiring Dorji and client Hermanshu Parwani, HP as he liked to be called, listened to tinny Nepali music playing from an iPhone in the third tent. Clients Hao Wu and Hans Hilscher occupied the tent on the end. They had just crawled wearily inside of their nylon shelters, their heads throbbing from the oxygen deprivation hangovers of their first night at 19,689-foot Camp 1, and thirsty and exhausted from their successful morning rotation to 21,000-foot Camp 2. Moments earlier, they had crossed quivering metal ladders over deep crevasses, scraping their crampons on the frozen metal as their gloved hands clutched thin ropes on either side. It was 11:56 a.m. on April 25th, 2015. Dave was wiggling out of his climbing harness and J.J. was bent over a camp stove melting snow to make tea when they felt the ground move in waves below them. Dave froze. At nearly 20,000 feet on Everest, he suddenly felt like he was in a boat on the ocean. He and J.J. glanced at each other and at the same time said, "Earthquake." All eight of the climbers instinctively shot their heads out of their four tents, but, socked in by the weather, they could see nothing but snow falling and a dense gray fog as the ground below them rocked. "What is this? Dave, what's going on? Is this normal?" shouted HP from his tent. Then, above them, they heard a roar of cracking ice. Avalanches began to rumble downward, echoing in the bowl between the mountains that amplified sound like an amphitheater. The ground jolted and dropped. In the first tent, Robbie Massey remembered what he had said to his family when they expressed concern about the 2014 icefall avalanche. "Lightning doesn't strike twice," he had told them. "Oh my God," J.J. blurted. Dave took a mental inventory of the situation. Mount Everest was shaking like jello. He and his team were camped between two crevasses and below 3,000-foot-high towers of ice. Avalanches thundered down every mountainside around them. He found himself considering whether it would feel better to die from an avalanche off of the peak of Nupsi or from one off of Everest's west shoulder. During those brief seconds of assessment, which stretched out in slow motion, he also took stock of the possibilities that the ice shelf on which they were camped could collapse out from under them, or could break loose and slide 3,000 feet down into the icefall. "It's an earthquake," he heard himself shout, "but we're all right." "Zip up your tents and stay inside them," Chiring instructed. "Get your helmets and transceivers on." The bewildered team obeyed, sliding on their helmets and strapping on their transceivers as they stared wide-eyed at their tentmates. HP's hands trembled while he set his beacon to transmit mode. The roar of snow and ice grew louder and closer. Robbie and Peter grappled with tent zippers flapping wildly in the wind as they contemplated their own deaths. Chiring thought of his wife, pregnant with their first child. The ground below them shook violently, swaying and popping. Before they could manage to zip all their tent flaps and vents shut, they were hit. 2. Kathmandu, March 24, 2015. Posted by Dave Hahn. Categories: Expedition Dispatches, Everest. Elevation: 4,383 feet. RMI Expeditions Blog. We had climbers circling the thunderclouds, climbers flying back and forth to Delhi, planes delayed back on the Great Plains. But ultimately, we had the entire RMI Mount Everest 2015 climbing team assembled on time, and with all gear at the Yak and Yeti Hotel in Kathmandu. Six climbers, two base camp trekkers, two guides, one base camp manager, and one Sherpa Sirdar enjoyed a fine dinner together, without so much as one person falling asleep at the table. Quite a feat, considering all the time zones and datelines crossed. By the time of the expedition in 2015, Dave had already summited Everest 15 times, more than any other non-Nepali. He had summited North America's Denali 21 times, Antarctica's Vinson Massif 35 times, Africa's Kilimanjaro 3 times, South America's Aconcagua once, and Cho-O-Yu, Everest's near neighbor to the west, 2 times. At last count, he had guided clients to the summit of Washington's Mount Rainier 275 times. Elite members of the climbing community likened him to the Michael Jordan, Cal Ripken, or Michael Phelps of the climbing world, while emphasizing the distinction that Dave had not only shattered world records, but had done it while climbing as a working guide, with non-professional climber clients safely in tow. Still, Dave felt a wave of nerves when he let himself into his hotel room at the Yak and Yeti, turned on the lights, and saw a message from Miss Elizabeth Hawley waiting for him on the nightstand. Somehow, she always seemed to know just when he had landed in Kathmandu. He slid his backpack off of his shoulders and stretched his long legs out on the bed. He was jet-lagged, and his stomach felt full from the dinner he, J.J. Cheering, their base camp manager, Tucker, and their 2015 RMI Everest Expedition clients had devoured downstairs in the restaurant. He closed his eyes, just for a moment. All in all, it had been a happy evening. They hadn't discussed any of the intricacies of Everest yet. They had spent it simply getting acquainted and reacquainted with each other and celebrating their arrival in Nepal, as well as client Peter Rogers' birthday. In spite of the pleasantries, Dave couldn't get the ice fall off his mind. The chunk of glacier that calved off of Everest the previous season, in 2014, crashing down below the west shoulder and then detonating like a bomb blast above the Khumbu icefall, had been the size of a 10-story building. He trusted that the icefall doctors, a team of Nepalese mountaineers hired by the government and charged with the formidable task of building and maintaining a rope and ladder passage through the glacial labyrinth of the icefall, would find the best possible route through the constantly moving crevasses of the Khumbu. And he knew that, ultimately, Mother Nature was in charge. What he feared was that the explosive avalanche of ice and the death and grief it had caused may have revealed equally significant fractures in the relationships between the Western guides and the Sherpas, two groups who shared so much and who routinely put their lives on the line for each other. By the time Dave opened his eyes again, sunlight streamed through the windows. He stood up and pulled the gauzy curtains back. The hotel, built as an elegant theater and palace residence over a century earlier, during the Rana dynasty, still emanated the nostalgic glamour of a bygone era, with its neoclassical architecture, salmon-colored walls, ornately carved windows, emerald green gardens, and winged Garuda statues guarding pagoda shrines. Dave jolted when he spotted out the window Miss Elizabeth Hawley's driver, Subin, and her 1963 royal blue Volkswagen Beetle, already waiting for him in the parking lot below. He hurried downstairs. Dave ducked his head and squeezed his 6-foot, 2-inch frame into the Beetle's passenger seat, pulling his knees up to his scruffy, square chin as they left the confines of the hotel and barreled through the streets, choked with smoke-spewing trucks, rattling old-school buses, and buzzing motorcycles. Horns bleated and yelped like the goats that shared the streets. The familiar smell of exhaust fumes, wet earth, laundry soap, cumin, coriander, turmeric, rotting fruit, sewage, and milk tea wafted through his window. Stray dogs and monkeys scampered across ancient gilded stupas, the dome-shaped Buddha shrines dotting the city. They wove through throngs of people, Western tourists with cameras dangling from their necks, wandering Hindu sadhus in saffron-colored robes, sari-clad women, uniformed school children, and marigold vendors. They drove past impossibly stacked office buildings, vegetable stands, apartment complexes, and finally into a quiet residential neighborhood, and up a driveway ringed by manicured footpaths and lilac bushes, to Miss Hawley's home. Dave unfolded himself from his seat, thanked Subin, and passed through a black iron gate. He let himself inside the house and walked up the stairs to her office. A string of bells on the screen door jingled behind him. 92-year-old Miss Elizabeth Hawley greeted him matter-of-factly from behind her desk, peering over her glasses at Dave. He thought she actually looked glad to see him, though he was pretty sure she was trying not to show it. Miss Hawley slid her glasses, through which her eyes appeared even larger and more piercing, back up the bridge of her nose and stood up. She wore her typical uniform on her slender, bird-like frame, a floral, short-sleeved blouse with a Peter Pan collar, a crisp khaki shirt, and sandals. "Hello, Elizabeth," he said. He smiled and hunched his shoulders, as if to tower over her less. "On time, as usual. I couldn't swear that I'd see you back here after what happened last year," she said. Dave nodded. "I told you I'd be back." "Please, sit down. I would have met you at the hotel, but you know I'm not getting any younger, and my balance isn't getting any better. Would you like a cool drink?" Miss Elizabeth Hawley had served as Everest's unofficial, yet legendary gatekeeper and record keeper for the last 50 years. Born in Chicago and raised in Scarsdale, New York, she quit her research job at Fortune magazine in New York City when she grew bored of sitting behind a desk to go travel the world and figure out what she wanted to do next. She ended up in Kathmandu in the Himalayan Kingdom of Nepal in September of 1960, soon after the country's curtain had been lifted to foreigners, and after Westerners had begun attempting to conquer the world's highest peaks. The opening of virgin Nepal to the outside world, and the subsequent influx of climbers, fascinated her. In a letter to her mother, she wrote, "The mountains hereabouts are infested with men mad enough to want to slog to the tops." She found work as a reporter with the Reuters news agency, covering the high-altitude dramas unfolding in what had previously been known as the Forbidden Kingdom, and never left. Her extensive expedition records, which she collected over time as journalistic research, had since been archived in her authoritative Himalayan database. Dave first met Elizabeth Hawley, universally known in the climbing community as Miss Hawley, during the 1990s, while leading trips on Cho Oyu before his first Everest trip, as an expedition lead guide in 1998. She made a point of interviewing every lead guide both before and after their expeditions to gather pertinent information for her records. Some refer to her meticulous interrogations as Everest's second summit. Dave thought back to one of his first post-trip interviews, when she had asked him at what point he had turned on his supplemental oxygen on the way up Everest. He had answered 24,000 feet, which was about 1,000 feet lower than he normally would turn on oxygen on the North Face route, and he had done it because he was aiding a sick client. He still winced when he recalled the way Miss Hawley had then squinted at him and said, "Huh, bringing Everest down to your own size?" Dave, offended by the implication that he had somehow cheated, had responded by asking her what mountains she had climbed. "Oh, I've never climbed," she had replied coolly. "I wouldn't think of it. I want to sleep in a bed, eat at a table, and be driven around in my Beetle." Their relationship had warmed into one of genuine affection and mutual respect over the years, particularly after a historic expedition in 1999, when Dave helped find the body of British explorer George Mallory, lost on the north face of Everest in 1924. Since then, Dave had received the American Alpine Club's David A. Sowles Memorial Award for unselfish valor in 2001 for his rescues on Mount Everest, and he was recognized in the same year by the National Park Service for rescues he performed on Mount McKinley. He had been honored by the Nepal Mountaineering Association for his rescue of a climber in distress above 27,000 feet on Everest's south side in 2007. And he had been presented a Citizens Award for bravery from the U.S. Department of the Interior in 2009 for a rescue on Mount Rainier. In spite of this, Miss Holly remained hard to impress, and Dave remained more than a little intimidated by her. She began to fill out the forms on her desk. "How many members at beginning?" she asked. 6 clients, 2 base camp trekkers, 2 guides, 1 Sherpa Sirdar, and 1 base camp manager. Names? Clients are Robbie Massey, Hermanshu Parwani, Larry Seaton, Peter Rogers, Hao Wu, and Hans Hilscher. Our base camp trekkers are Aaron Machinchik and Bonnie Rogers. Base camp manager is Mark Tucker. Assistant guide is J.J. Jussman. Cheering Dorji is our Sherpa Sirdar. After the long days he had just spent traveling halfway around the globe from his home in Taos, New Mexico, to the typical circus of the Yak and Yeti hotel lobby, Dave realized he was enjoying having a moment to just sit and talk with Miss Hawley in the respite of her quiet house. Through the window, blue mimosa trees blossomed in the courtyard, filling the room with their honey, almond, and cucumber scent. He had been too uneasy to sleep on the flights. Having spent the 8 previous months guiding the highest peaks of Antarctica, North America, and Africa in relative anonymity, he knew Everest would be, as always, in the spotlight. In terms of public perception, at least, it remained the gold standard, the Olympic arena of mountain climbing. The world had a way of noticing what happened on Everest. With the 2014 season upended, and without having succeeded in getting any of his 3 clients to the summit in 2013, he felt the pressure, more than ever, to perform. He felt the need to prove himself. Once they completed the requisite paperwork, Miss Hawley handed Dave another stack of forms for his team, with questions ranging from the details of each 8,000-meter peak previously climbed to current relationship status. They smelled like the mothballs she kept in her filing cabinet. "Make sure they fill them out, and fill them out correctly," she directed. Then Miss Hawley, ever businesslike, thanked Dave and sent him on his way. It was official. The only rituals left for him to perform were to secure the expedition permit from the Ministry of Tourism over handshakes and cups of sweet tea, and to stop in for a haircut and straight razor shave at his favorite barbershop in Kathmandu. He was going back to Everest. 3. Okinawa. And the 3 men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, they caught the last train for the coast, the day the music died. Bye-bye, Miss American Pie, Don McLean, 1971. The Everest expedition, in its entirety, would take 2 months. Everest's 29,029-foot, 8,848-meter summit was infamous for being roughly the cruising altitude of a jetliner, and for having approximately the same surface area as a dining room table. From the first attempt on Everest in 1923 to Dave's first summit in 1994, the ratio of deaths to summits on Everest hovered at around 1 death for every 5 successful summits. According to Miss Hawley's Himalayan database, the most common causes of deaths on Everest included avalanches, falls, and ice fall collapses. Dave seemed to have made a lifelong habit of surviving harrowing and often lonely journeys, beginning with his childhood. The 3rd child of Ronald, Ron, and Isabel, Han, Dave was born in Okinawa, Japan, a chain of 2 dozen green islands lying in crystal-clear, turquoise tropical waters. Okinawa translates from Japanese as rope in the open sea. Ringed by white sand beaches and coral reefs, and carpeted by fields of sugar cane, the islands of Okinawa comprise Japan's southernmost prefecture, in the East China Sea, between Taiwan and mainland Japan. In spite of its tranquil beauty, Okinawa was notorious for having been the site of a bloody 82-day battle during World War II. 95,000 Imperial Japanese Army troops and 12,510 Americans were killed there, with 50,000 more Americans wounded. Its fields and caves were still steeped in sadness. Ron and Isabel met at Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas, while both were serving in the Army. Isabel as an occupational therapist, and Ron on a path that eventually led to Lieutenant Colonel. Isabel was also a classically trained pianist and a painter. Ron had grown up rock climbing in Yosemite. They found they shared a love of music, art, and the outdoors. They married, and shortly afterward moved to Okinawa when Ron was stationed there. All three of their children were born in Okinawa, David in 1961, 2 years after his sister Carolyn, and a year after his brother Harold. Shortly after Dave's birth, Isabel was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer of the lymphatic system that limits the body's ability to fight infection. At the time Isabel was diagnosed, the 5-year survival rates of Hodgkin's disease were still below 10%. When Dave was 6 weeks old, the family moved from Okinawa to the Bay Area of Northern California, settling in Mountain View, where Ron worked for IBM. While Isabel was treated in San Francisco for several months at a military hospital at the Presidio, Dave, still an infant, lived with his aunt. Isabel painted watercolors of her view, through tall cypress and eucalyptus trees, of the Golden Gate Bridge from her hospital bed for her children. Dave was vaguely aware during his childhood of his mother's illness. The scar at her throat, where doctors had removed tissue for testing, was one of the only outward indications that there was something wrong. At home, Dave loved to listen to his mother play Beethoven on the piano in the living room. While he and his father often butted heads, Dave felt safe and content in his mother's presence. On family camping trips, his eyes lit up when she read to him and Harold and Carolyn outside in the sunshine, pushing her dark hair behind her ears, as she delighted them with Charlotte's Web and James and the Giant Peach and Black Beauty. For Dave, Mountain View was home. Even at a very young age, he recognized that Mountain View, named for its serene view of the Santa Cruz Mountains, was quickly becoming the center of many worlds. Shockley Semiconductor Laboratory, the first company to develop silicon semiconductor devices, had opened for business in Mountain View in 1956, giving rise to what would come to be known as Silicon Valley. As Mountain View's aerospace and electronics industries boomed, its population did as well, and its agricultural past faded into history. Dave relished the adventure of his family's occasional road trips from California to visit his grandma Chela and the rest of his mother's family in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where they lived between the Sandia Mountains and the Rio Grande. Along the way, his parents strapped harnesses onto him and Carolyn and Harold so they could keep track of their young children while they roamed through museums and national parks, and snapped photos of them standing in the foreground of the sheer, massive walls of Yosemite's El Capitan. It was during these journeys that Dave saw his first snow, while on a side trip to the Sierras, and his first desert, the Mojave, as the highway from California stretched into Arizona. He was captivated by the sight of scorpions, snakes, and road runners, and the crack in the pavement where the San Andreas Fault had caused the road to split. At gas stations, his parents bought postcards and maps, arrowheads and polished rocks for the kids. Dave pocketed the trinkets, but was most interested in the maps. He spread them out over his small lap and tried to understand where the highways went, tracing the state lines with his fingers. It was on these road trips, while he and his brother and sister laughed and argued in the back seat, that his parents seemed happy together. In the summer of 1969, when Dave was 7 years old, the Hahn family moved to Kingston, New York, in the Hudson Valley, home to another IBM plant. As their furniture was being moved into their new house on President's Place on a humid July day, Dave watched the Apollo moon landing on the TV and the quiet coolness of their motel room at the Holiday Inn. He was mesmerized by the sight of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin raising the American flag on the moon's barren surface in what Aldrin called the magnificent desolation of the lunar landscape. For Dave, the transition to Kingston was startling. While Mountain View had felt exciting to him, like a place on the verge of becoming, Kingston felt to Dave like a place whose time had passed. While Mountain View's economy thrived, Kingston remained largely depressed. It was the victim of a failed, federally funded urban renewal project in the 1960s that replace old neighborhoods with housing projects, segregated from the rest of the city. As a result, many of its downtown buildings remained boarded up.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?